This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 8th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to the 152nd edition of Culture, with me, Robert Bound, brought to you in association with Persol. Today, we're thinking big. We'll head to Chatsworth House to see some big works of art, sculpture that can only really live outdoors. The Duke of Devonshire, whose place it is, loves the look of it.
I think that a lot of our visitors have really changed their minds about contemporary sculpture because of this exhibition, and certainly it's helped me learn a lot about artists I knew nothing about.
We'll be in Sydney to see more intriguing art outside. Public art makes us want to sing.
It's a kind of weird balance between the artwork giving you something that you've asked for, but inevitably giving you something that you didn't have the smarts to ask for. And that's why working with artists is so brilliant.
And we'll find the funny side of the dark side. Beirut's La Bomba laughs through the mortars.
You're using sense of humor while talking about dead people and casualties. In my opinion, this is the only way to talk about such tragic events, because otherwise you cannot handle the tragedy.
Plus, we'll see what jihad does to music in Mali, and we'll get a zingy live Midori House session from Calgary's weirdo popper, Chad Van Galen. He's made one of the great records of the year. That's all to come here on Culture, with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So, a song for starters, and as we've just told you, Chad Van Galen is our entertainer this week. The Canadian musician makes weirdo pop with the deft touch of a practice expert in his left field. That's the same fertile Calgary scene that's birthed lo-fi melodic gems such as up-and-coming band Viet Cong, whose singer Scott Munro joined Chad for our Midori House session. Chad is a multifaceted artist who's just as likely to be creating surreal animations as he is music. For today, he's put the paint down and is playing some songs off his latest record, Shrink Dust, and we'll begin with Cut Off My Hands.
Cut off both my hands and threw them in the sand. Watch them swim away from me like a pair of bloody crabs. Close my eyes and dream of different skies. Stare straight at the sun and try not to cry for you. Oh no. Doused in waves of static haze, I grew my mind into a maze. It makes me sick to even think of it. Fall asleep and disappear. Pop some pills to chase your fear. She said, I love you both the same before she drifted away. Captured by the jackals and thrown into a hole. They tortured you for days and then let you go home. I can see them now, just flapping in the wind, like a giant stinking mouth that's been shooting out spit. Oh no. Oh no.
That was Chad Van Galen with Cut Off My Hands. Let's hope he didn't, so he can play more for the rest of the show. Off we merrily go then to look at some sculptures in a pretty special place. Chatsworth House, one of the better piles in the land, seat of the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire, has been showing large works outside and in, so that the paint doesn't run, of sculpture for 9 years in conjunction with Sotheby's. It's a selling show, but you'll need a large trolley in which to wheel your purchases home. Amongst pieces new to the Palladian Gardens of Chatsworth this year are a work by Zhu Bing, an entire dreamlike landscape built around a carp pond, an actual one, one of Anthony Gormley's big rust figures lying prone in a quad, a beautiful nude bronze by Aristide Maillol lying tantalisingly in that famous stepped waterfall, a giant bronze cowrie shell by Mark Quinn, and Morrow, Christopher Lebrun's huge and handsome marble wing upended like a sail next to the Emperor's fountain. I spoke to Christopher about the challenge of Chatsworth House and then to the Duke of Devonshire about why he gives a home to these wonderful works.
My name is Christopher Lebrun. I'm here at Chatsworth. I've made a sculpture in Greek Nestos marble called Morrow, which is standing by the lake.
We're standing outside in nature, Christopher, actually kind of outside where we had lunch rather than in the amazing vista where your piece resides at the moment. And what sort of challenge is it once you've made a piece to place it and knowing where it's going to end up?
This is a particular challenge because it's one of the most beautiful landscaped gardens in England, almost in the world. So it's as if having the ideal plinth, don't mess it up. So, but this sculpture is very simple. It's white and it's against a background of perfect lawns, lake, sky, building with its gilded windows. So actually it's quite difficult to mess it up. And it was really helpful with people who knew the landscape to give a bit of advice. And we spent some time thinking about it before putting it here.
And do you have to sort of mooch around the plot? Do you have to imagine when you're in your studio and when you're even sketching something like this out before it's made, where it's going to end up? Because context, I mean, especially in such a place as this, context is king, isn't it? Or it's key, at least.
Yeah, and it needs a lot of imagination because I sit in my South London Camberwell studio, of which the view...
You're not telling us it's different, are you?
It's not comparable in any way. I apply my imagination and dream where I would like the sculpture. And actually, this, it's a sort of a dream. You know, it's a wonderful Claude Lorraine landscape in which one of my sculptures is sitting. So you're absolutely right. What the context brings to it in this artificially made landscape is perfect for art. It's very different from putting it in a city street thronged with people. This is sitting already in a piece of art. Not only a piece of art, but a piece of art with terrific hinterland and history and depth and thoughtfulness and all the things you'd... As you can tell, I'm enthusiastic.
And the piece itself, it's a beautiful thing. It's obviously a piece taken from nature. It's a wing, but it could be a stalagmite. It could be the jawbone of some huge dinosaur. There's something kind of... We're not entirely at peace, perhaps, with your work, are we?
No. It's very important that you somehow delay perception of a work of art. If you think, oh, it's a wing, got it, you move away. But as long as you can keep the spectator as intrigued as I am by the form, for example, if you turn this form sideways, it's just a very, very slender column, as you said, you know, rather beautifully as like a white stalactite. That's really important. It mustn't be descriptive. Because as a work of art, it immediately has an ambiguity about it. It's evocative. So to just straight describe something immediately somehow short-circuits the process of being with the piece and thinking about it. Just keeps it open.
You're a painter. So what's this huge piece of marble doing in this garden?
Well, look, I'm a painter and I spend my life putting things in places. Most of the time, I'm putting this brush mark or this dab of red on this white field. I just spend my whole life... I can't sit and have lunch without rearranging my knife and fork. And it drives my family crazy. I will move the salt and pepper until it's just what I do. So what happens in this case is I have this wonderful opportunity to put this gorgeous piece of marble from Greece in this Greek landscape.
It's an interesting way of looking at art, not necessarily the curation of it, but just simply where it ends up. I mean, I know all artists, once they give birth, are always interested in where their baby ends up. You must be particularly interested in that side of things then.
I'm very interested in it. You know, one rather envies poets. There's the sonnet. It has its perfect form. It lives deathlessly in its form. But you can mess up art. You can really mess it up. Wrong context, wrong frame, wrong lighting. It's vulnerable. One day it may come back to life, but you really want to look after it as much as you can and think really hard about where it's been seen. So what's special about this exhibition is how thoughtfully everything's been placed. You go further up the lawn, there's a red Philip King. And you come back, look the other way, there's a white piece by me. And these things are really part of the whole experience. Walking through a landscape... Look, the idea that a work of art is static, that you stand in front of a picture and look at it, that's it. No, it isn't. Even the painting, you see it at night, in the morning, you know, artificial light. And here, the effect is doubled. You know, we stood in front of that sculpture and the fine spray of the 200-foot Emperor Fountain.
The Emperor Fountain, yeah, we can go into that. We'll ask the Duke about that.
And that's typical. It's real. You're right in the world. So the photograph of it is something... completely different, but your context is really crucial.
I guess every piece is supposed to have a conversation with another piece. This sort of thing, this pudding can be over-egged, but you must be happy with where it is, because it has commanding, if I was an estate agent, I would say it has commanding views.
It's, well, look, looking from one direction, there's the landscape park, there's the house, there's the fountain, there's the lake, there's some other sculpture. It's very, very nice. It's very nice.
It's time we went back to Camberwell, isn't it? Sadly, it is. Christopher, thank you very much for your time. So we're sort of asking, when a beautiful garden is not a beautiful garden or it's used for something else, a number of things have come from outer space almost and landed at Chatsworth. Where did the genesis of this sculpture project come from?
I think the genesis was 10 or 11 years ago, just after my father died, and we were here and... Sotheby's senior management had that annual retreat. It happened to be here. And it was beautiful June, lovely summer evening. And we were looking out over the lawn from the front of the house. And somebody said, why don't we do Isleworth here? And I didn't know what that meant. But Isleworth's a golf course in Florida where Sotheby's used to have big sculpture exhibitions and sell mostly by cattle. So that seemed like a good idea. And it just grew from there. And we said, yes, we'll do that. And then we made an arrangement with Sotheby's, and it's worked ever since. So this is the ninth year. They pretty much, except for one year when we just had Barry Flanagan work, which was wonderful, but the mixed shows seem to be the most popular with our visitors.
And it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because there's obviously, you're a collector yourself. This is the point where personal taste meets perhaps what you think all the thousands, tens of thousands of visitors to Chatsworth House are going to like. There's quite an interesting conversation going on there. Or is it an arm wrestling match?
It's not an arm wrestling match. All the pieces that are chosen by Sotheby's, they're all for sale. Sometimes they're commissioned by the artist. Sometimes we're selling for a client. So Amanda and I don't have any influence on the work that comes, nor indeed on the where it's placed, although Simon Stock very kindly does sometimes discuss it with us, but he's very, very good at it. And he's opened our eyes. For instance, the Gormley in the inner court, beautiful place. I would never have thought of that.
And is that the thing? I mean, there's a lot of the artists have spoken to artists today that have been wowed by the context in which their work has ended up. From a studio in Camberwell, for example, to one of your lawns is quite an amazing sort of journey to make. It must be a good feeling to be able to enable artists to sort of let these huge works really breathe some air and some fresh air.
Yes, it is. It's a great privilege. And the more we do it, the more we get to know some of the artists. Several artists have had work more than once, some almost every year. And the point about the garden at Chatsworth, the garden in a way is a bit of a misnomer. The house, garden and park are really one work of land art. And when we asked our visitors 2 or 3 years ago why they came to Chatsworth, it wasn't the collection, it wasn't the architecture, it wasn't the sculpture in the garden, it was the landscape. And the landscape is absolutely the fundamental work of art from which everything else flows, the feeling of being here. It was a sort of political statement in the 18th century, and it's not a political statement anymore, but it just is, happens to be very beautiful, and I think that strikes a chord with almost everybody who comes here. The sculpture is an added layer to that and works often very, very well indeed.
And how interested are you in wandering around behind some of the visitors to hear what they say about the works? I always ask artists this question, whether they want to know what people think of their work, rightly or wrongly, or maybe they'll discover something new that they didn't know they'd made themselves. But I wonder about you, when it's in your backyard, as it were, how people appreciate what there is out there.
I think that for a lot of people in this part of England, where there isn't much contemporary sculpture easily available, the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, which is magnificent, is an hour and a half nearly away. I think it's been a thrilling journey for lots of us who live in Derbyshire to find this work very accessible, to find it explained, look it on the website, check it out, and learn about it. I think that a lot of our visitors have really changed their minds about contemporary sculpture because of this exhibition. And certainly it's helped me learn a lot about artists I knew nothing about.
And one of the things, before we switched the microphones on, when you welcomed us earlier on, you made a nice comment about, you know, grandchildren potentially teaching their grandparents about this artist, that artist, why they particularly like something. That's kind of a really nice entry point. That must have been something that had happened to make you tell us that.
I think that we, every year we have a teacher's evening. It's tomorrow evening, as it happens. And 200 or 300 or more teachers come. They get taken round, they get given some materials about the work. And then as many of them as possible bring school parties here in the next month or so. And very soon after the first school parties have been, we see grandchildren and grandparents hand in hand looking at a completely abstract piece of bright pink metal. And I have a feeling, I may well be wrong, but I have a feeling that quite a lot of those people of my generation, the grandparents, wouldn't probably spend much time looking at that art. But the grandchildren are their way in. The grandchildren have understood it, they've had it explained to them. They relate to it or don't relate, they laugh at it. They don't care what other people think. They make a lot of noise. Inside the house, it's quite quiet. As soon as you get people into the garden with the sculpture, the children make a lot of noise and they point and they laugh and they really enjoy it. And I think it enables, as I say, the grandparent generation not to be scared of it, not to be put off by the fact it's modern and doesn't look like anything they recognise, but just to enjoy it through their grandchildren's eyes. And that's wonderful.
And there is that thing also, that childlike thing with appreciating art, or getting it or not getting it doesn't really matter. It's all about asking the direct question. We could do with a bit more of that, perhaps.
Yes, I think so. I think that young children can't really verbalise in a very sophisticated way because they have a fairly small vocabulary. We have a larger vocabulary and we try and say, oh, it reminds me of what it looks like. That, I don't think, is often what the artists really intend. They want a visceral reaction, and children will give them a visceral reaction better than... We sort of feel we ought to react in a certain way sometimes, which is a pity, but that's what education and fashion and these things do to us. Seeing it through grandchildren, we can forget about all that, all those Emperor's New Clothes on behalf of the viewer disappear, and we just connect to the work.
That was the Duke of Devonshire at Chatsworth House. For more information on Beyond Limits, the sculpture exhibition, head to chatsworthhouse.org. After the break, we're going to head to Beirut for a bit of light relief.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, it seems you can't open a newspaper anymore without reading about turmoil in the Middle East. Sometimes it's easy to forget that for many who live there, life still has to go on as normal. In Beirut, one Lebanese band, The Great Departed, is providing much-needed relief to the region by offering the only solution they can, laughter. Venetia Rainey goes to one of their gigs to find out more.
In a crowded room smothered in red velvet, The Great Departed have started to play. Two floors above us, on the streets of the commercial centre of Beirut, Hamra, people are gearing up for a night of drinking and shisha smoking. The topic of conversation will eventually turn to the latest grim news from the region. It's relentlessly depressing, but down here, at Metro El Medina, The Great Departed have found a way to turn all of that on its head, by poking fun at it. So how did this six-person satirical band come together? Male lead singer Naim Asmar explains.
Well, the band officially started in 2013, and she had her first concert last year. But the members of the band knew each other a long time before and worked together in other bands and other projects that were mainly classical or traditional Arabic music projects before. Khalid plays the keyboard in the band, Khalid Subayh. Abid Baisi plays the buzuq, which is like a lute-like instrument, but slightly different. Imad plays the oud, or the lute. I'm the male lead singer, Naim Asmar, and there's Sandy, the female lead singer, Sandy Shamoun. It's some traditional form of Arabic music where they used to call it the bitana, which means the singers who basically sing the whole song where at times the lead singer comes to the front.
Their first big hit was Gas and Alcohol Don't Mixi, which mercilessly mocked former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi for speaking pidgin English during a speech in Europe. Within days, it had gone viral, and it's still one of their best-known songs. But Don't Mixi was one of their few political songs last year, a stark contrast to their current repertoire, which Asmar explains was purposeful.
Because in the last year, mainly politics took the majority of our time, our thoughts, even our dreams, our daily talks. So we wanted actually to think of something that concerns us really, and also concerns the audience, the people who are listening. I think definitely the audience, as we saw, feels more concerned, and to a certain extent that they feel like the band is talking about what they would like to talk about, but maybe don't really do because they are bombarded by what the media tells them. And the severity of the situation, it's hard to talk about it. Maybe this is why the band chose to talk about it with this weird sense of humor. Like when you're using sense of humor while talking about dead people and casualties. But in my opinion, this is the only way to talk about such tragic events, because otherwise you cannot handle the tragedy of it.
One of the songs they play is a twist on a straight-up newscast. It exemplifies how, for Khalid Sobih, the main writer and keyboard player, an element of satire is unavoidable when talking about current events in the Middle East.
We didn't have the intention to make satire, really. When you sing these words, that are describing what is happening in our country and in our area. So maybe you have to follow the lyrics in your music. That's it.
The reason they are making waves at the moment, however, is because of a hilariously irreverent song about the Islamic State and its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Because Islam is merciful, we shall butcher and hand out meat, go the lyrics. And because we need to reduce traffic, we will blow up human beings. O Master Baghdadi, the song laments, you will lead God's servants to an abyss like no other. It may sound like traditional Arabic music, but The Great Departed is intentionally riffing on a genre that they feel is outdated in order to talk about issues such as oppression and dictatorships.
Well, it's the music that it's our background, it's our base, and it's very important to be rooted, really rooted in that music. But after a while, repeating the traditional repertoire as it is doesn't do it for you anymore. They used to sing about love and platonic love and about beauty and about God sometimes, and this doesn't do it anymore today, because in our daily life this is not what we talk about. I wish we had time to talk more about love and relationships and flowers and nature, but we don't really find time for it. We're mostly preoccupied about politics and about the whole situation.
With the situation in the Middle East continuing to deteriorate, it looks like The Great Departed won't be talking about flowers or love anytime soon. Luckily for the Arab world, that also means a little bit more laughter during otherwise dark times. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thanks, Venetia. And from Beirut to Bamako, in the second half of the show, we'll head to the Malian capital to see how politics plays a part in their diminished music scene. There's more of that live Midori House session from Chad Van Galen too, and we'll find out what's been commissioned by a public art scheme in Sydney after a rather large influx of cash. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Chad Van Galen is our man with a guitar this week. He shoots the breeze with Monocle's Tom Hall. But before that, here he is with Hangman's Son.
He was the hangman's son. Wouldn't crack a smile till the deal was done. He was the only one laughing as he sang that we all shall hang. Oh, have mercy on the demons that curse me. The sense to run. Was the hanged man's son. He said every day's a curse and the curse just gets worse. Now you're on the run. You can smell his dirty work, 'cause now you're wearing his shirt. You left in the night on your 10-speed bicycle. Well, it was a great beginning. Yeah, everyone was cheering for you, and now I stand on your grave with nothing to say to you. Well, I wonder how you lay buried deep in the ground.
We're very lucky to be joined by Chad Van Galen, all the way from Calgary, Canada. You just played us three really beautiful songs there, and that's from your new record, Shrink Dust.
Yeah.
Bit of an obvious question, but I have just been wondering, since that record came out, what is Shrink Dust? What does that apply to?
Shrink Dust was something that we kind of come up with stupid band names constantly. I'm sure like every band on the road. And Matt Flagel, who was touring with us at the time, I think said Shrink Dust or something along those lines. And I thought it was pretty perfect. And then when this record came along, it was kind of like the themes of the songs were sort of like Alice in Wonderland. That sounds pretty dumb, but... But yeah, I thought kind of Shrink Dust was the perfect sort of magic potion metaphor.
Is it about making things small to get some perspective or something? Or...
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Or completely not?
No, yeah, just some sort of magical dust, I don't know.
And you mentioned band names there, like joke ones or otherwise. You work with a lot of bands, either as sometimes as a producer, and obviously you're a musician yourself. You seem to be the archetype of a very busy man, because you do animation. I'm told you make instruments as well.
I'm a dad, and that's the busiest thing that you could possibly busy yourself with.
Yeah, that yeah. too. I mean, how do you maybe find time, and how do you divide your time across all those different disciplines?
Just my studio, everything's really close together within arm's reach, so it's a bit of a headache, actually. I'll probably die when I'm 42 of just pure stress from stressing out about not finishing things on time. Or, yeah, I guess as being a dad has sort of compartmentalized my time a lot too. So believe it or not, I feel like I'm more productive now just because when I do have the time, you know, if I get a 3-hour chunk of time, I'm just like, I got to go write a techno record in 3 hours. And then I should be at like X Games for making art or something like that. Cause it's just like, okay, I got to make a zine by... 5 o'clock.
I mean, you make records under different monikers, and you know, there's the Black Mold and things like that.
Right.
I mean, how much of Chad Van Galen do we get to see? Is there just volumes of stuff that we don't know about?
There are, but I mean, I don't know how much of that stuff is really necessary to expose to the public. I do try, and when I have time, I do sort of slowly release it on Flemish Eye on the Canadian site. All the stuff that I release under different names, we have sort of a charity thing where we kind of pick a charity to donate money to. I think this year it's probably going to have something to do with just sort of preserving natural environments around where we live, just to sort of keep it closer to where we are so we can know what it does, or SPCA or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, but that's like sort of a good excuse to kind of put out piles of garbage into people's ear holes, because I don't really want to, at that point, I don't really want to take responsibility for a lot of this stuff, because it's like, it'll be like a 24-minute long noise track that probably sounds pretty horrible to 90% of the population. But.
And looking at your kind of output, like a lot of it seems to use a lot of really kind of surreal imagery, and you know, you seem to have like quite a sort of dark sense of humor. Like just now we were talking about Shreddy's cereal, and you came up with shredded monkey heads for your cereal.
Oh no, I said boiled monkey hand.
Oh, well, there you are. There
I
you
thought
are.
That was like a classic British meal.
Oh, maybe.
Blood
maybe.
Pudding and boiled
out.
Monkey hand.
I've missed out. I mean, where does that kind of ambition to not be operating in a very real world sense all the time, where does that come from? Is that like escapism? Or
I think I've been drawing since I was a kid, and really into sort of, when I was a kid, my dad had a lot of sort of Freak Brothers and Robert Crumb I was exposed to a lot of comics that I probably shouldn't have been reading when I was that age. And maybe that's what kind of got me into the surreal imagery. And then from out of that, I got really into kind of like Metal Hurlant and Mobius sort of things when I was a preteen.
But there's something, although a lot of it is just sort of crazy to look at and really kind of out there, like there's something also like weirdly profound in some of it. And also like your songs, I mean, it sounds like you're trying to put a serious point across sometimes.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So is there a profoundness in weirdness?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I feel like everybody feels pretty weird. Like weird is the new normal kind of situation for a lot of people, I think. So maybe I've been focusing on it long enough to sort of express it in a way that gets it the point across sometimes. I don't, not all the times, that's for sure. I feel pretty weird, so I feel like I sort of have to work that out of my mind.
At the weird X Games that you're going to be competing.
The weird X Games, yeah. The weird X Games would be awesome.
That was Chad Van Galen speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. His record, Shrink Dust, is out now on Sub Pop, and that's Galen with a double A if you're Googling. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I'm Robert Bound. Now, the City of Sydney has announced an ambitious public art scheme, a $9 million investment for three artworks to be installed in the inner city. There were 700 proposals from 25 countries, and a panel of five had to whittle the list down to 10, then the final three. Anne Loxley, curator of C3 West at the Museum of Contemporary Art, is also a public art curator and was on the selection panel of the three artworks being commissioned. Zoe Ferguson spoke to Anne about Sydney's public art scene and how these three pieces will strengthen it and what they mean for Sydney. She started by explaining the works.
Yunya Ishigami's work is going to stand between 50 and 75 metres high in the square adjacent to Town Hall, and it looks like a ribbon-like twisting arch. Even though it's going to be made of steel, it has a kind of lightness and ephemerality of it, which is much more like a twisting ribbon. What is very beautiful about it is it's a kind of a gateway, it's kind of an arch, and the form, because of the wonderful subtle twists in this ribbon-like arch, formally it's incredibly dynamic, and the shape will actually be different depending on where you stand. British artist Tracy Emin is doing something very different from the Ishigami work. It's a cluster of bronze birds that will be in really surprising places in a number of the streets which cross George Street. There will be a plinth with a text inscription in one of the parks, and the text will be the distance of your heart. There's a wonderful thing that is behind her work, which is about connection and connectivity and just unashamedly kind of thinking about the people that you love. And I love the fact that we'll have to look for them. It's a great proposal. And then the final one is by, as I said, Haini Armanius Pavilion. And it's a meticulous enlargement of a blue milk crate. It'll be made of fiberglass. He's called it Pavilion. He is inspired by what he regards as the classicist formality, the architectural purity of the structure. I can see what he's saying. It's a very particular milk crate. In fact, it's the milk crate that he has had in his studio for many years. And this is a work he's wanted to make for many years. And he's going to put it in Belmore Park. It's not the most glamorous part of the city. I feel it'll be a wonderful addition to that part of town.
What was your role on the selection panel?
I have been a member of the City of Sydney's Public Art Advisory Panel for about 6 or 7 years, working on, you know, public domain strategies. All this work is, of course, occasioned by the fact that we're now going to have a George Street without cars, we're going to have light rail, we're going to have improved pedestrian amenity. All this work has been very much guided by the great Danish urban designer Jan Gehl. And in tandem with that, the city has done a whole lot of very serious policy and strategic work. So this plan, which was written by my colleague Barbara Flynn, another public art curator, is a result of a lot of very hard work by a big team in the City of Sydney, headed up by the very capable Bridget Smythe, who's the director of design. Sometimes it's proposals for public art in private development, and quite often it's this kind of work that the city itself is commissioning. So Barbara contacted hundreds and hundreds of artists all over the world. They all submitted an expression of interest. We shortlisted 10 artists, this committee, and then those artists then came up with their proposals. And then we had the very onerous but extremely privileged task of assessing those proposals.
And what characteristics in the artworks were you looking for them to be shortlisted and chosen?
It's a very funny thing when you're choosing works for commissions like these, because the briefs were all about connectivity, lending a sense of cohesion to George Street. And then, as I say, the connectivity was about the cross streets. Very, very, very difficult things for artists to do. And at times when we were going through it, we did wonder if the tasks were too hard. Then you see the Ishigama and you go, oh wow, that's going to be visible from the quay. That is going to announce this street like nothing else. And the symbolism and the poetry and the scale of it. It's a kind of weird balance between the artwork giving you something that you've asked for, but inevitably giving you something that you didn't have the smarts to ask for. And that's why working with artists is so brilliant.
How do you think a piece of public art does create that iconic stance? Is it time? Is it luck? Is it earning its memories?
I think it happens fast if it's going to happen. You know, when Anish Kapoor's Cloud Gate in Chicago was presented to the public, people just, the love was there immediately. But the reason why it's fabulous is the commissioners let that great artist do what he wanted to do, and they spent the money that needed to be spent. You wouldn't believe how much that work cost. I think a lot of the time that's what goes wrong in the public domain, especially in my country, unfortunately, where people do not put enough money to the projects. And I actually hope that we've got enough money set aside for these three. So not skimping and not compromising and not making the artists change their ideas to fit the budget. I know that sounds petulant, but it's what I believe.
Is public art always a topic of contention because of taxpayers complaining and everyone has an opinion about what they deem is good art or bad art?
Yeah, public art is usually contentious. People can always talk about the taxpayers. I think any time taxpayers' money is involved, you know, contemporary art can cop it. The important thing with the public domain and controversy is to actually do what my colleagues at the city did do, I think, which is just don't lose your head. Hold tight. If you believe in the project, ride out the storm. You know, the Opera House was a controversy. People are fickle. So it's very important to protect the concept and the artist and just to hold strong and firm.
What is a city or a society without art?
I'm crazy about art. Art is one of the reasons I can get up every day. I have no interest in a city without art, but I also hate bad public art. Bad public art is worse than no art. There's always good art somewhere. There's a lot of great art in Sydney, not much of it in the public domain.
That was curator Anne Loxley speaking to Zoe Ferguson in Sydney. And after the break, a little more music in conflict, but this time in Mali.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. In Mali, if you want to get a message out, bring a guitar or any other instrument for that matter. Music is everywhere in this vast land, from the desert in the north to the banks of the majestic Niger River in the south. Or rather, music was everywhere. Ever since 2012, when jihadist militants conquered Mali's desert cities, music has become scarce. The jihadists banned almost all music. Instruments were burned and people had their music collections replaced with cassettes of Quranic chanting. As a result, the music scene in Mali's desert regions is dead, and even in the capital Bamako, it's now only a shadow of its former self. But even in this rather bleak landscape, there are artists of the Never Say Die variety. Bram Posthumus was in Bamako recently and met two of them, and here is his story.
If you want to get around in the Malian capital, you will need one of those cheap, noisy Chinese motorbikes. So it was on a bike that I arrived at the home of Mohamed Sumbunu, Mali's foremost rap star, whose artist name is Milmo N. Sahel. Milmo fills up large concert halls and stadiums with ease. What's his secret?
La confiance de Milmo en soi-même.
I'm confident. Also, we work with traditional Malian instruments and mix these with modern sounds. So it is rap, but with a traditional angle, you see.
Malians won't forget the year 2012 anytime soon. There was a rebel invasion, a coup. Jihadists destroyed the mythical town of Timbuktu, and while all this was happening, Milmo was busy producing rap videos about it all and putting them on YouTube.
We recorded 10 songs between 2012 and this year. I tried to follow what was going on, so when the coup happened in March 2012, it took us just 2 days to record a song and put it on YouTube. And the last one I did was just before the presidential elections. I asked Malians to vote, not for someone who gave them T-shirts and tea, but for someone who would run the country well.
Last year, Milmo joined 37 musicians to record a song called Maliko. It means For Mali. The impressive cast reads like a who's who of the Malian music scene, all united in a message of peace. Mali doesn't do songs without a message. I'm on my way to the outskirts of Bamako to meet a musician who has his own way of commenting on the state of affairs in this country and its music scene. It's so far from the center here that it feels as if we're in a rural Malian village. But there is electricity, and Umar and his friends have set up the band for a little home performance.
I'm Umar Konate. When I was 10 years old, I started learning different guitar techniques. I was living in Gao at the time. It's my hometown. I was born there, 1,000 miles from Bamako. I moved here to study, and now I have a career in music and a job working for the state.
I ask Umar why he's working for the state.
Even before the crisis, the music industry here was not going anywhere. Take CDs, for instance. The minute I put a CD on the market, someone would buy a copy, put it onto his computer, and then sell my album for 30 pence to anyone who wants my music on their phone. I make no money from it because copyright doesn't exist. We only make money through live performances.
The country's artists are united in their conviction that Mali's predicament can only be solved when Malians start recognizing who they are and where they come from.
The message on my new album is that we must remind ourselves of old Mali. If the present hurts, we need to look at the past. And today the present hurts. So I've gone back to the ancient times of the Mali Empire, when our ancestors laid down everyone's rights and obligations. People must remember Mali's past achievements and build a new Mali on those foundations.
Hey.
In this song, I talk about the elders of Timbuktu, the saints who are buried in that city, the old religious leaders, those who wrote all those ancient documents. This song is my way of honouring all those people.
The words of Umar Konate there. Fatoumata Diawara, the singer who brought the musicians together for Mali Ko, once told me this. For us, music is everything. It educates, it solves conflicts, it tells the truth. Indeed, Mali still has its ancient voice, and so far, no one has succeeded in silencing it. For Monocle, in Bamako, I'm Bram Posthumus.
Thanks, Bram. And that takes us to the end of this week's show. Next time we'll be at Art Rio in Brazil, and there's live music from ballet school. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, who, despite her slightly spangled return from the End of the Road Festival at the end of the English summertime here, has nonetheless managed to flick the switches with style one last time. Time for one final song. Here is Chad Van Galen again with Weighted Sin. Thank you for tuning in.
I lay my head down on the track, my eyes just roll on back. Last night I weighed my sin. Last night I weighed my. Last night I weighed my sins. Last night I weighed my. I fell my way back home. My head was buried underneath the stone. Last night I weighed my sin.